Welcome to Spoiler Peace Theater, the podcast that doesn't give a shit about spoilers. We just want to talk about the movies. My name is Evan Crean. I am co-chair of the Boston Online Film Critics Association, co-author of Your 80s Movie Guide to Better Living, and my pronouns are he, him.
My name is Megan Kearns. I write film reviews for Edge Media Network. I, too, am a member of the Boston Online Film Critics Association, and my pronouns are she, her.
My name is Dave Riedel. My pronouns are he, him. I write about movies, and I am also a member of the Boston Online Film Critics Association.
Yeah, you are.
I am.
On this week's show, we're going to talk about some movies. But before we get to those, wanted to mention our Patreon segment this week. Our Patreon exclusive audio, we're talking about A League of Their Own, which was coincidentally another movie involving Tom Hanks that we hadn't planned for in this week's coverage, but it was a really fun conversation. It was a lot of fun talking about that movie again. I hadn't seen it in ages. And so consider joining our Patreon. You could go to patreon.com/spoilerpiece, sign up, and you'll get exclusive audio. You can vote in polls and all kinds of other good stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a good time.
On this week's show, we happen to pick three movies that all have one word titles.
We sure did.
And when you say them together, it sounds like you're communicating something, which is even stranger. We've got Beans, Passing, Finch. Yes, those are three different titles. Beans, Passing, and Finch.
I prefer Finch, Passing, Beans, but that's just...
Or Passing, you know. Finch, Beans.
Yes, that's my
Passing
favorite.
Finch Beans. Too. And Frank's.
What kind
for
of
that
beans,
matter.
Though? Garbanzo beans? Green beans?
Lima.
No, never.
I don't think we ever find out what kind of beans. Although no. It's not that kind of movie. No. It's not a movie about food. That's actually the first movie we're going to talk about. Beans. It is a drama.
Yeah, I'll say.
Beans is actually in a coming of age movie. Beans is actually the main character. That's a nickname, though. The one-sentence plot summary here is based on true events. Tracy Deer's debut feature chronicles the 78-day standoff between two Mohawk communities and government forces in 1990 in Quebec. So written and directed by Tracy Deer, co-written by Meredith Vuchnik?
I'm going to go with Vuchnik.
Vuchnik. All right. Yeah, as I mentioned, it's a coming-of-age story. Our main character... Beans is her nickname. She is considering going to like a fancy Canadian private school. The movie opens on her trying, sharing the pronunciation of her name, and the principal, headmaster, whoever's interviewing her tries several times unsuccessfully to pronounce her name. And then she just says, "Everybody calls me Beans." So yeah, she's got a younger sister. Her mom is pregnant and, you know, typical kind of like working class family. And then what happens is in their community, there's a golf course that is going to, they want to expand, and they want to expand onto Mohawk tribal land, specifically like a Mohawk cemetery and sacred forest, and they want to put the golf course there. And so in the opening of the film, you know, they're kind of camped out there peacefully protesting any kind of construction. And then the cops fire tear gas into the forest where they are, where Beans and her mom and her sister have gone to kind of join the peaceful protest. And from there, things escalate. And so everyone in the community arms themselves. They actually blockade the area. The cops form their own blockade, and thus commences this standoff. And it's all about these families navigating this issue, and also Beans just coming of age through all of it. And that transition from being kind of a sweet, innocent kid to learning about adult issues, you know, violent conflict, the way that, you know, people are racist against indigenous people. And there's some pretty, pretty intense scenes of that in this movie. But I'm curious what both of you thought about it.
This is not a period of history, of Canadian history, of indigenous history or First Nations history that I was familiar with. So I was very glad to see a film that addresses this topic, because there's I mean, one, straight out of the gate, there's not enough Indigenous representation in film. I love that this is made by a Mohawk director about Mohawk people. I think that that's great. And I really like the actress who plays Beans. I think she's very charming.
Yeah, she's good.
Yeah, she's really good. She's very charming. I love seeing her transition from kind of sweet naivete to horror and terror as to what she's witnessing, and also her transition to anger and to being kind of angry at everyone for this horrific racism and oppression that she's experiencing and that she's witnessing. And I think it's something we don't see often enough in film, is we don't see the pivotal role of anger, especially for women and non-binary people and marginalized people in general, people of color, and how it really is a harbinger to, I'm not being respected, I'm not being treated fairly or okay. And Indigenous people have been oppressed for so long, and it's there's so much genocide that they've endured, and it's just awful. And I think that this film does a really interesting job kind of weaving in news footage, but also a child's perspective of this. And Tracy Deer did actually live through this and did experience this and did witness this. So I know it's a very, from what I've read, it's a very personal film for her. And I think she brings that personal touch to the film.
Yeah, it feels very personal, very authentic. And like you, Megan, I was really glad that this film exists, because I was also not familiar with these events and this history. And so I feel glad that I've seen this film and to understand about this conflict, and also just to see this coming of age. Like you said, it really is important to see the representation, especially going through those phases and culminating in that anger, that understandable anger at oppression and racism. Like I mentioned, there's some pretty intense scenes. There's a scene where her mom is driving her and her sister through, they're leaving their community, and there are people pelting rocks, large rocks, at their car. And it is extremely terrifying, unsettling, angering, especially later when they've somehow managed to make it through. And there's these cops that are sitting there laughing, and Beans gets angry and throws rocks at them. And
it's an interesting scene.
There's definitely some emotionally intense moments.
Yeah, that scene is kind of fascinating, because you've got the two cops who are assholes, and Beans throws rocks at both of them. And one of the cops, the smaller one, let's call him the smaller one with the mustache, is ready to like smack a 13-year-old child. And the other cop is like, don't do that. She's a kid. But I just, the whole time I was watching this, what I just kept thinking was, and I don't know a lot about Canadian Indigenous people's history, other than that there was genocide in Canada too, just like everywhere else. It just made me sad. The whole thing just made me so sad, because nothing's 30 years, 31 years later, and what's really all that different?
Nothing.
For any person, for any marginalized person. And I would argue for some people it's worse. So, so I don't really have a lot to say, other than I think this is really well made, and I think it's really important that a Mohawk person wrote and directed this, because I think that you get a lot of unvarnished, I think you get the horror, and I don't mean in a horror movie sense, I think you get the horror in a rather unfiltered way that you might not get if, you know, Penny Marshall directed this, since we're talking
or any white person, we were but talking yes.
about, or any white person, but we talked about right. Penny yeah, Marshall no, of on course. League of Our Own. So I just sobbed throughout this entire movie, and I had a very strange, conflicting emotional feeling when Beans, about 2/3 of the way through, they're staying in a hotel because they can't live in their homes anymore, and they've been pelted with all these rocks by the Quebecois, who are fucking horrible.
Yeah, and that did actually happen, by the way. I
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
I was doing research after seeing this movie, and yeah, that actually happened, which is awful.
The history of Quebec within Canada is just crazy in and of itself. I mean, it's just, I mean, Canada's history is just, the more you read about it, you're like, good God. Like, I think all these people are putting on airs about how nice everyone is. But mm-hmm.
It's almost like it was whitewashed.
Yeah.
Oh, imagine that.
But what I mean is the scene about two thirds of the way through when they're staying at the hotel and they've just done 2 minutes in heaven, which is just a terrible idea if you're 12 years old. But then they're at the pool table and then there are those two Quebecois girls and Beans just beats the shit out of the older one. And I had this really bizarre feeling of like, oh my God, she's beating the shit out of this poor kid who's just like, she's a 10-year-old. Getting the crap kicked out of her, and she doesn't deserve that. But then Beans, you know, like she has every right to be just as angry as anybody could possibly be. And just the notion that violence just creates more violence, and that's all it really does, no matter how righteous it is. Just, oh God. So anyway, so I'm not really going to be too useful on Beans other than to say that it's really, really good and really heartbreaking. And there you go.
Well, I think that was useful. And I think you are useful.
Thanks.
But I think I'm so glad you brought up that scene actually, because that was, I think that's one of the most uncomfortable scenes. And I think intentionally so, because
for sure,
you know, part of me is like, no, don't beat up her. She didn't do anything. But then, of course, it's like, well, of course, Beans feels this way. And she's like, fuck white people. And I'm like, yes. But then at the same time, I'm also like, but don't hurt that girl, you know? And it's so conflicting. And it's such a great scene for that reason. And it's such a great choice that Tracy Deer makes to show that. And I also think her, Beans' mom's reaction is really interesting, too. Like, we suffer and we have to endure. And you know, now you've made them hate us even more. And the fact, and I am very sure this is a conversation that happens throughout many, many people of colors, indigenous peoples, conversations with their children, something that white, you know, parents should be talking to their children about, but don't have to, of course, because of white privilege. But the fact that you have to think about, you have to swallow your own pain and you have to swallow your anger in order to make other people not hate you. And so you won't have to deal with as much racism, or hopefully, like, it's just, it's ridiculous.
Right.
It's so horrible and awful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's that idea of like having to be a model minority and like representing your people. And instead of just being a person, an individual yourself,
and
I can't imagine what that's like for someone to go through. It's, I'm literally sure, infuriating, frustrating, any number of things, but I'm glad that they included that moment in the movie, because I think that is an integral struggle.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. And yeah, I think it's important to see, because I'm sure First Nations people will relate to that. And I'm, as many other people of color probably will too. And I think it's important for white people to see it, to see how difficult it is to have to balance those impossible, conflicting feelings and thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to try to say something useful here. And also, I was just thinking about all of the dynamics within the Mohawk community too.
Yes, right.
Because you've got kind of what on the outside, Beans' family looks like kind of a conventional, you know, middle class, lower middle class family, like we were talking about. But then you have, is it April? Is that her tough older friend's name?
Mm-hmm.
Then you have April, who's just like got a completely different family dynamic. And she's got a brother that she kind of hates. But because he's a total fucking dick. Oh, I'm so glad that Beans scratched his face. Because I was just like, we don't have to get into the, like, you know, to the sexual assault scene, just because, just the dynamic that you know, April basically says, yeah, I know exactly what just happened to you because gross, it happened to me and my family. And then she's like, don't tell anybody that because I'll fucking kill you. And it's just like, oh my God, where is this movie going? And just you think about all of the layers and the layers and the layers and the layers and the layers. And not just of these particular families, but any family and just the horribleness. And this movie this is going to sound stupid, but it's a thinker. There's so many levels of everything. Mm-hmm. Class issues, race issues, financial issues, gender. Which of course ties into class and race, gender issues. Yeah, just issues. I don't even like using the word issues. I try to use the word problems, but that pisses me off.
No, I think issues is more accurate, but anyway.
Well, in this case, I think it is. I think it is more accurate.
But also, when you're talking about the different dynamics, I love that you brought up the families, but there's also different dynamics within the same families, because when the men are at the barricades and they have the guns pointed, the Mohawk men have the guns pointed at the cops and the cops have the guns pointed at them, and the Mohawk women stand in between and are like, you know, if we want respect, we have to be respectful, which I don't agree with that stance. But of course, I am a white person, so I have absolutely no skin in the game and no, you know, however people of color want to address and indigenous people want to address problems, that's their call, certainly not mine. Mm-hmm. But it's really interesting to see that there's that divide where, you know, some of the women disagree with the men's tactics, even within their own community. And so that's great to see too, that we're seeing divergent perspectives and divergent ways of how to deal with this problem and issue.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and regardless of what they're saying, it's a fucking brave decision to stand out there in between two sets of people pointing guns at each other.
Yes.
With itchy trigger fingers. I mean, yes. Like that to me was spoke volumes about the courage of those women, mm-hmm. to stand in between both sets of people and say, we need to de-escalate this. It doesn't matter how, we will literally put ourselves in harm's way to help de-escalate the situation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. 100%. I also think it speaks, just knowing police brutality, especially towards, you know, Black people and other people of color, you know, and brown people. I think it's also interesting the fact that the women stand in between their men and the cops too, because it's just, I mean, of course it's horrifying because like you said, itchy trigger fingers, but it also just knowing the history of police brutality too, it just adds like another layer, like the fact that they're willing to risk their lives in this moment, but also that they're doing it to hopefully prevent more deaths and more brutality down the road too.
For sure. A lot of layers in this movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As Dave said, a thinker.
Yeah, I was just going to say, there's another layer that I was just thinking about when the women go and stand between their husbands or the men in the Mohawk side of the blockade and the cops, that most of the women are facing the police, but three of the women are facing the Mohawk, mm-hmm. men, and one of them is Beans's mother. And I think that's an interesting point. Like, she's looking at her husband.
Yep.
Which I'm sure is intentional. It's not just like, oh yeah, you stand there. No, it's like, no, you're going to be looking at your husband here. Mm-hmm. And also the scene when the kids are throwing like water balloons and shit at the police, and then one of them throws a fucking Molotov cocktail.
I know.
And oh, just God. Like escalation. And it's just like, and then you have poor Beans, who all of those other kids kind of, even if they're kind of immature about what they're doing, they know what a Molotov cocktail is. Whereas Beans is just kind of like, the fuck just happened? And then it takes her like an extra 4 seconds to like turn around and run. And it's just like, that's what I mean when I say layers. There's just so much, mm-hmm. in this movie. So anyway.
Yeah. And I just want to harken back to what you said, Dave, about how it's great that it's a Mohawk filmmaker who made this film. And I completely agree. Also, I was thinking about it after you said that. If a white person made this film, they would probably try to like humanize the white people, kind of do like a both sides shit bullshit issue thing. And no, mm-hmm. fuck that. And I'm so glad that we don't get that perspective, you know, and we see how racist, right. the white people are in the news footage. Like, I'm glad we see that because that is necessary to see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we see it in them throwing rocks at the cars. Yep. We see it in that tense standoff where they take the boat to town and all the crowd of people block, you know, them from getting to their boat and you're worried for their safety. And it's just...
And how none of them cares that there's a seven-year-old and all
no,
of that.
Right. No, and right. Sister. And one of the women even says, you're scaring the children, and they don't... Nope, they don't care.
Right. And like, so they mention as kind of a throwaway line somewhere in the news footage about people being mad about their commute being fucked up. Because like, you look at this group of people that's angry and you're like, I'm pretty sure that like 99% of these people are not angry because they don't get an extra golf course. It's they're just angry because these people are standing up for themselves and taking their space mm-hmm. and not allowing themselves to be... you know, walked all over. Mm-hmm. And that is just so clear throughout the film.
Mm-hmm. No, you're absolutely right. And what I couldn't help but think of is I remember, you know, there have been multiple Black Lives Matter marches and protests. And there was one time one of the bridges here in Boston was impacted commute-wise because people were marching. And hearing people complain about their commute, I'm like, are you fucking kidding me? I'm like, Black people are being murdered and you care more about your goddamn commute to work? Like, your priorities are fucked here. Like, what is wrong with you? And the same, and it's like, how much has changed in 30 years? Dave, you said that? Sadly, not much. Because the fact that people care about a golf course more than people's lives, or that they care more about commuting over a bridge than people's lives, it's so fucked up. It's so, it's just so awful, obviously.
Mm-hmm. For sure. Well, on that somber note, is there anything else we wanted to say about Beans before we move on to a movie I think that will evoke similar feelings of frustration?
Oh.
Intellectual frustration, yes. Not frustration with the
film.
No,
yes, I do, yes.
No, I'm all set with Beans.
Yeah, okay. Beans is a hard watch, but I think it's an important watch.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
Oh, all right, so I do have one last thing to say.
Okay.
I will say I really liked that at the end, and it you know, couldn't help but think of Lady Bird, but I really like that she says her First Nation Mohawk name at the very end of the film. She's like, nope, fuck that. I'm not going to make it easy for you and give you my, you know, Beans nickname. I like that.
Yes, that was a really great moment. She's standing in front of the new class, her new classmates at the private school that she's going to, and that is a great way to wrap the movie. Okay, so moving on, we are going to talk about Passing, which is going to, it's in theaters now. It's going to be available on Netflix in the near future.
November 10th.
Written and directed by Rebecca Hall, and it is based on a novel by Nella Larson. Let's read the one sentence plot summary. Passing follows the unexpected reunion of two high school friends whose renewed acquaintance ignites a mutual obsession that threatens both of their carefully constructed realities. I'm going to expand on that. We have Tessa Thompson, who plays Rini, and Ruth Negga, who plays Claire. And they are Tessa Thompson. Her character is married to a doctor, and she lives in Harlem, and she has an upper class Black family, society, community. And Ruth Negga is married to Alexander Skarsgård, and she is passing for white. He does not know that she's Black, and they have a kid together. And so they're old friends, and they end up reconnecting. They end up seeing each other at a hotel. I don't really know. Do we remember why Rini is there in the first place? I don't.
I do.
She's going there to have tea, right?
Yeah, she goes to a store first to pick up a toy for her child because it's his birthday for her son, and she is trying to pass for white too.
Yeah,
that's which is right. Something she doesn't normally do, but she wanted to do it this afternoon.
Right, and that's how she ends up seeing Ruth Negga there, and then they reconnect. The film is also in black and white.
It's in 4:3.
Yes, it is.
It is. It's set during the 20s, right?
Yeah, like 1929, like right before the crash. It feels like. Because it's still jazz age, flappers kind of stuff, but...
Right. New York City, very kind of jazzy score going on. This little kind of jazz interlude that repeats throughout the film. Like a piano, like a jazzy piano.
Yes, that actually, that score should sound familiar because it's also in the documentary Time.
Huh.
Yeah, it's by, I hope I pronounced this correctly, but I very well may not. It's Amahe... Sieg Mariam Gebru, And she was an Ethiopian nun and piano player. And so that score is used very intentionally in passing as Claire's theme in Irene's head, according to Rebecca Hall, the director.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah, there's usually this kind of like light exposure kind of thing going on as well on screen. It's kind of like a, I don't even know how to describe it at the same time. So, Megan, you saw this at Sundance, right?
I did, and I talked about it on our Sundance episode. This was my favorite film at Sundance, and it is still one of my absolute favorite films of the year.
It is really good. I'm glad I finally got a chance to see it. I remember you talking about it and mentioning how good it was. Mm-hmm. And similarly to Beans, I think this is a very layered film.
Yes.
There's a lot of different dynamics and conversations going on. In this film, it's less action oriented than, say, Beans. Like, there's not a lot of like crazy action going on, but there is a lot of conversations between characters in rooms, and they're having very detailed, dynamic conversations about race and about class. And so I feel like that's this movie's strength, is like the strength of the performances, but also of the dialogue and the conversations between the characters. And for me, what I think is just an absolutely haunting ending that left me just kind of reeling.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure it could have ended any other way.
Yeah.
Like from a dramatic standpoint, from an everything standpoint, you know?
Yeah. I will say again what I said earlier when I talked about this after I saw it at Sundance. I mean, I completely agree with you, Evan. I think the performances are unbelievably outstanding. I mean, I always love mm-hmm. Tessa Thompson and Ruth Negga. I always love them. I always know they're going to give a fantastic performance in whatever they're in. And I think they have so much chemistry together. And I think Ruth Negga, and I've read a lot of interviews with both of them and with Rebecca Hall. And it's really interesting watching this a second time that Ruth Negga has kind of the easier role because it's the showier role. It's the charismatic role. It's, you know, mm-hmm. everybody loves Claire. Well, not everybody, but most people do. They gravitate to her because she's so magnetic. And then Rini, everything's happening internally for her and she doesn't really express mm-hmm. who she truly is. And that's a really difficult thing to convey. And I think Tessa Thompson does it brilliantly. And I think this has exquisite cinematography. I love it. It's gorgeous. I kept pausing the film while watching it a second time. And every single shot looks like a beautiful painting. Like it's so exquisitely composed. I love it. And I think this is a really fascinating examination of race and gender and class and how jealousy interplays into relationships and also what happens when the facade of a meticulous identity cracks. I said that on Twitter. I said this when I talked about it before and I'll say it again because it's very easy to think about Claire's identity cracking because her husband, who is a raging racist, oh my God.
Oh, wow.
Wow, so bad. And
the nickname, that scene where he's like, oh, did you hear what he called me? And I was like, I'm pretty sure I did. Yeah. And now we're going to get the explanation.
Oh my God. Yeah, the N-word shortened is her nickname. Because she keeps getting darker mm-hmm. each year and she was Lily White when he met her. Oh my God, it's like so horrible. But, you know, you would think that mm-hmm. that's the identity that's cracking, is that her world is cracking. But no, it's actually not, because Claire knows who she is. She knows what she wants. She goes for it with gusto. Whereas Rini does not know who she is or what she wants. And mm-hmm. she's the one whose life is completely crumbling and falling apart. And I also find it really fascinating looking at this film through a queer lens because I completely, completely read Rini's watching of Claire as a queer gaze. And when I read an interview with Tessa Thompson, who is a queer woman, she said she played this as a queer character because that it's very ambiguous in the novel and it's arguably mm-hmm. ambiguous in the film too. But it's very clear that she has this kind of pull and obsession and jealousy but fascination with Claire.
Yeah. I don't know. I didn't find it super ambiguous. I mean, there were definitely moments that I feel like harkened back to a potential romance in their past. Like the way that they reached out to each other and clutched each other's hands mm-hmm. felt like very, like we have a shared past history, relationship. And I'm blanking on it, but there was definitely one other moment that I had like kind of noted that I was like, yep, okay. Definitely seems like there was, you know, they had a relationship that was more than just friendship at some point in the past.
Are you talking about when
it's kind of like,
I was curious, are you talking about the moment when they're at the dance and she grabs her hand and then pulls away when men come over?
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, that's a lover's hand grab. And it's such a queer woman giveaway when you see hands. Like, it's like the marker of every queer woman film.
Yeah. The hands are very important. I know.
Very important. Indeed. But I didn't think it was ambiguous either, but I think it can be read as ambiguous people. Like, I'm sure there are some people, certainly perhaps many straight people who are like, oh, I don't get that. But, you know, but I'm glad that you also saw that too, Evan.
Yeah.
I mean, I saw it too, and I would use the word ambiguous if only because it's not explicit.
Right, you know? Exactly.
But what I was fascinated most with about this was how much everything is subtext.
Yes.
I mean, there's a lot of, you know, what's on top of the subtext? The text. There's a lot of text, but and they do in particular. Claire has a thing where she explains exactly who she is, like you were saying, Megan, exactly who she is. She goes for what she wants, blah, blah, blah. And then Renee has a moment at the end when she has accidentally, through no fault of her own, given away to Claire's husband that Claire is passing, and they're going to that party and they're on the stairs and Renee's trailing behind Claire and her husband, Brian. And she's like, what would you do if, I can't remember her husband, your asshole John. Husband, John, thank you.
John
Alexander
Q.
Skarsgård, who like every time I see him, I'm just like, I really wish he would stop being in things because I know people like him. But every time I see him, I'm like, oh, look, it's Alexander Skarsgård. Every time. Like I never look at him and think, oh, you're a character. I just think, oh, you're a tall Swedish guy. Anyway.
I look at him as a character and I think he's a great actor, but I digress.
He bugs me. So anyway,
and he plays a great asshole.
That's true. And he does. Yeah. He does play an asshole well. So anyway, they're on the stairs and Rainey's like, well, what would you do if like John found out? And I can't remember what Claire says, but I think that's, you know, Claire or Rainey's like kind of explicit moment, but everything else with Rainey or Irene or, you know, whatever Rainer to her older friends, it's like, everything with her is unspoken.
Yes.
Everything is on Tessa Thompson's face as opposed to coming out of her mouth. You know, it's a really, really, I don't want to use the word subtle because I don't know how subtle it actually is, but it's, you know, the way she looks says so much.
Yeah.
And the way Ruth Negga looks says so much too. She's just not on a screen as much as Tessa Thompson is. So I was also kind of struck by what I considered a rather frank portrayal of can't get out of bed depression in the last 20-30 minutes of the movie that Rainey has. I was like, oh wow, I didn't expect this. They're fucking Rebecca Hall's going for it, you know. So I haven't read the source material, so I don't, you know, what that's like in the novel, but I think that's a really smart choice to show the physical manifestation of this relationship that has kind of knocked Rainey on her ass, for lack of a better term. And also how you realize whether she's actually conservative or whether it's just because she's so repressed, Rainey's conservatism, and not in the contemporary sense of conservative, and Claire's, for lack of a better term, liberalism, her just like kind of living openly, even though she's passing, she's being more authentic to her true self because she's, like you were saying, Megan, she's going for the thing, whereas Rainey's just like, I don't know what the thing is.
But that is what's so interesting, because it seems on the surface,
yes,
like Rainey is the one living more authentically because she's living in Harlem and she's married to a darker skinned black man, and but it's like the reverse. It's so cool.
Yeah. And then just the what really struck me was how that comes out, how you realize how conservative she actually is when she's talking, when Brian is telling her boys, their boys, their two boys, about the lynching in, I can't remember, St. Louis, somewhere in the Midwest. And he's just being frank, completely frank about it. And she's like, come on, they're children. Don't do this. They're going to find out about this eventually. And he's like, they've got to find out now so they're prepared. And she's like, no. And it's just this whole, oh my God, it's heartbreaking. Mm-hmm. And then I also wanted to mention, by the way, that somebody help me out with Brian, the actor's
Andre
name.
Holland.
Andre Holland. God damn, he's
always
good. He's so always good.
Always love him.
Yeah. I just the absolute pitch perfect performance for that role, that husband. And I also wanted to get your reactions, the two of you. Ooh. The final scene when Claire falls to her death because John comes and breaks up this party where they're all having a good time, because why wouldn't they be having a good time? It's a party. And John comes in and says, you know, my wife is a dirty, you know, you're a dirty liar. And Renee has just opened the windows to get some air so she can, because she's just feeling like, basically like she's going to die. John comes in, calls his wife a dirty liar. Ruth Negga is standing by the open window. And you could read it three yep. ways. You could read it, she jumps. Tessa Thompson pushes her accidentally or on purpose, or her husband pushes yep. her. There's three very distinct possibilities it could be. Mm-hmm. And the first, I watched it twice because I was like, well, that was clumsy. And yeah. then I wound Mm-mm. it back and I'm like, oh no, that was totally on purpose.
It was on purpose, yep.
You're not supposed to know, did she get pushed? Who pushed her if she got pushed? Mm-hmm. Or did her husband do it? Or did she jump?
Yeah. I rewatched as well because I was eager to see if I could figure out, but it is unclear. And I think for me, it struck me as possibly accidental of, you know, Tessa Thompson reaching to sweep Ruth Negga out of the way and accidentally knocking her out the window. But like, I think at the end of the day, like, I don't know how much it really matters. It's just, it's equally tragic no matter how you look at it. It's like tragic right. if the husband did it. It's tragic if she jumped. It's tragic if she accidentally got pushed out. It's also tragic if her friend felt like she needed to quote unquote get rid of her. Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah.
It's yeah. equally haunting that kind of slow aerial shot at the end mm-hmm. Over the, you know, her body and the courtyard. It's just, oh my God.
Yeah. Her pristine body in the white snow. I mean, yep. my God.
I think the other thing too that's really fascinating about that scene is when Renee is standing there and everybody's like bolted to go down to get to help Claire, get her body, whatever the case may be, find out what happened. And Renee just freezes and kind of stands there and she's like holding onto her hands. Like we see a back shot of her looking out the window, like almost in disbelief, like what really happened. And it is so fascinating because you're right. It is so tragic, but it's also so like, what did happen? I don't know. Any way you slice it, she's going to be racked with guilt and just devastated over what happened, no matter what is the actual thing that happened. And it's just, ugh. But by the way, I want to talk yep. about a couple of things that have been kind of percolating in our conversation. So this was an incredibly difficult film to get made. Rebecca Hall tried to get it made for like 7 years, something like that. And people would always say they were very interested, but this is not going to actually get sold. And then they'd be like, oh, well, if it does get sold, it's not going to make any money and you're going to have to make it for no money. And then people would be like, well, we'll make it, but you have to make it in color. And she refused. And she said that she risked not making the film at all in order to keep it in black and white because she wanted it that badly, because that's how she envisioned it, because she wanted to have black actresses in the lead roles and she wanted to show the shades of gray, like visually and also thematically. And that was all extremely important to her. And the other thing that I think is really fascinating in the behind the scenes of this is when I heard that Rebecca Hall, whom I love as an actress so much, and now I love her as a filmmaker, when I found out she was making this film, I was like, well, this is great that, you know, a biracial black woman wrote this novel. But I'm like, but why is a white woman directing it? But here's the thing. Rebecca Hall has passing in her own family history. Her grandfather was a black man who passed. And so this is when she read Nella Larsen's novel, she said that there was finally all this language for all the things that had been talked about and not talked about in her family. And I just, that's why this book resonated so much with her, and she was compelled to make it. And I just, into a film. And I think that's just absolutely fascinating.
Hmm. Yeah.
What I also thought was fascinating is that Rebecca Hall's mother is Marie Ewing, who I know because because Joan is an opera singer.
Oh, well, so there you go.
I was like, oh my God.
Yeah.
I'm like, Maria Ewing is Rebecca Hall's mother. That's,
I know,
crazy.
Right? It's wild.
And so, a really famous opera singer, I might add. So yeah. So that's just another.
No, thing. But that's a really cool thing. But yeah, and the other thing about Rebecca Hall that I think is so fascinating, well, also that Tessa Thompson and Ruth Negga both said that they dropped everything to make this film. And Tessa Thompson, like, apparently was like set to do some other big project. And she's like, nope, I'm not doing it. I'm doing this. And which I also think is so great. And also speaking about Tessa Thompson's acting ability and kind of the layers that Rini has, Rebecca Hall said that as an actress, she's been told multiple times, you cannot display conflicting emotions or conflicting thoughts as an actor. She said she's been told that time and time again. And I'm like, well, that's not true. And she wanted to prove that wrong. And she said, because Rini's character is conveying so many conflicting things. So I just wanted to be like, yes, I agree. And I think Tessa Thompson does it masterfully.
She does. Yeah. She's always great.
She is always great. I think Rebecca Hall is always great. Renee is always great. Andre Holland's always great. Everybody's always great. But yeah, this is such a masterfully and meticulously crafted film. Like, and just reading the behind the scenes production of it, it just gave me even more respect for all of the choices that were made. There is not anything in this that is casual or by accident. Every single thing is incredibly intentional. Even going up and down the stairs, that was intentional. And it's just, oh, I love it. There's just so much to pick apart here. And I absolutely love that.
Agreed. It's a great film. Glad I finally got a chance to see it. And I look forward to more people being able to see it once it hits Netflix in a couple weeks.
Yes. Yes. Me too. Also, it shows how ridiculous just notions of race are. But what's very, very real, racism. Ugh.
Mm-hmm. All right. So we are talking about Finch, which is directed by Michael Sapochnik. It's written by Craig Luck and Ivor Powell. And it stars Tom Hanks, who we're happy to talk about in our Patreon episode. Happy to talk about him here as well. The plot summary is, in a post-apocalyptic world, a robot built to protect the life of his creator's beloved dog learns about life, love, friendship, and what it means to be human. I'm just going to say straight up, I knew I was going to love this movie just based on this plot summary.
Yeah, me too. Like, me too.
How sweet is it that a guy builds a robot to take care of his dog?
Yep.
Like, that is just, to me, the sweetest, most loving thing. And this movie, it goes for it. It is sweet and loving, but also like a tense, scary, post-apocalyptic movie. And I dig the special effects, I dig the performances, and I don't know, I was a fan, but I'm curious to hear what both of you thought.
I loved it.
Yeah, I mean, I liked it, but I liked it better the first time I saw it when it was called Chappie. I'm just kidding. Just because it's a robot as the main character, I really liked this a lot. I really did. I'm kind of wary of one person left alive movies ever since I saw I Am Legend, but when done well, you know, hey, rock and roll, man.
Well, that's the thing, though. He's not the only person left alive. It's just he's the only one we've seen for a long time.
Right. Well, right. And I mean, you could say that about I Am Legend, too. There are other people, as it turns out, in that.
Right. But that actually is intended to only be the last person left alive. Like, that's the premise of that. But anyway.
But then he finds out. But then he finds the other people.
Yes, he does.
Or actually, And anyway, we're not talking about those movies.
In this movie, he's aware of other people, but he chooses not to be near them because he is a bit of a misanthrope, and B, he just feels like it's safer to be away from them.
He's not wrong.
In the beginning, he's in Texas, Houston area.
No, St. Louis.
St. Louis. That's right. He's in St. Louis. His name is Finch.
Weinberg.
Finch Weinberg. He was a scientist, and he's kind of camped out at his old company. He's like made his home base there, and he's been driving around collecting supplies to build robots. He's got one named Dewey, which I thought great nod to Silent Running.
Yep.
Who's kind of like a dog robot, and he's got his dog. And yeah, he's been in the process of building a robot to take care of his dog because he has radiation poisoning that has been slowly killing him. And of course, you know, right when he's trying to complete the robot, there's some superstorm coming that's going to completely wipe out where he's been staying. So he has to take the robot on the road with only about 70% of the data that he originally planned to put into the robot. So the robot has a lot to learn.
In a very short amount of time.
Yes.
Yeah.
But he learns quickly. A road trip movie.
Mm-hmm. I know. I was like, was this movie made for me? I love dog companion movies. I love road trip movies. I love post-apocalyptic environmental movies. Like, it's like ticking all my boxes.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah. Animals don't die. I mean, like,
I know. It's great. Although Dewey people dies. Die, he's but not an no animal. Animals.
Well, yeah. I know. I felt really bad when Dewey. That was the other thing, though, is that was. That was so telegraphed.
I know.
And I wonder if you felt this way, Megan. Mm. You remember in The Last of Us when they get into Pittsburgh and they drive down the on-ramp?
I 100% thought of The Last of Us.
Totally. Yep. And even Tom Hanks even says it's a trap.
Yep.
And anybody with common sense would see that, but you don't have common sense. And the reason they go down the on-ramp in The Last of Us is not because they don't have common sense. It's because there's literally no other place to go.
But you know what's funny about that? Another nod to The Last of Us. Gustavo Santaolalla is the composer of The Last of Us and this.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Not lost on me.
That's interesting.
Yeah. What I really thought was an interesting choice was when they do go, you know, they go on the road and then Chappie is learning to be more Chappie. Jesus fuck.
His name is Jeff.
Jeff Dave.
Caleb Landry Jones is he's going into the hospital and he's in this abandoned hospital and he's using some things that Tom Hanks has taught him, but he's clearly out of his element and it is a trap, although it's not a great trap, although that Dewey does get killed.
Hello.
And you can see that coming and that's sad because you're like, don't go for the full box of cookies. What's wrong with you
or donuts or whatever they are?
Yeah, there's a bear trap. Don't do it.
Yeah, but then when you see the car following them for miles and miles and miles, I thought that was a really smart choice to just have that be a thing that comes and goes.
Yep.
And then their problem is not people again, but it's Tom Hanks's or Finch's lack. It's him being a misanthrope that has actually put them in danger. Really, even though you know, Jeff.
Right. Jeff doesn't want to ride under the underpass. And then Finch slams on the gas and then gets the RV stuck and just completely ruins the solar panels on top that have been keeping the RV going.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Oof. And also it ties in, in this case, Finch's, you know, reluctance to go anywhere. He kind of says at the movie, he's like, well, I've never really been anywhere other than St. Louis. I went to New York once and it was dirty. So he's, you know, they're going to San Francisco because of the big storm that's sweeping through St. Louis. They get out west. And then they find out the ozone depletion is not life-threatening in the West the way it is in the Midwest. Mm-hmm. And if he had ever traveled anywhere or talked to anybody, he may have known that.
Very sad.
So, yep. And now he's got radiation poisoning and he coughs up blood in himself and he's going to die.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, that gets really sad toward the end of the movie when you know he's dying and death is closer and closer and closer. And there's the scenes where they're just kind of parked in the RV and they're hanging out outside. And Jeff is playing with the dog or learning to get the dog to trust him. And then when he does die, oh boy, that was tough.
Yeah. I mean, this whole movie was hard. Just, you know, although the thing that was funny, not funny, but strange to me when Tom Hanks is telling the story about how he found the dog that he names Goodyear. And it's because of this standoff between this guy and this mother and daughter. And the guy shoots the mother and daughter to death and steals their stuff. And it turns out the dog is a puppy who was in the little girl's backpack. His speech was good, but for some reason, the emotional moment didn't hit me the same way some of the other emotional moments did.
Oh, interesting.
And you know me, child in danger, instant tears.
Instant tears.
Well, I think it's because I just knew that's what the story was leading toward.
I mean, I knew it too. Didn't matter. I was still devastated.
I think if this movie has one problem, and it's not really even a problem, it is predictable, unfortunately. But it's still done well enough, I think, that it doesn't matter so much. I think the performances are strong enough, and the relationship between Jeff and Finch, I have a hard time calling Tom Hanks Finch, but the relationship between Jeff and Finch blossoms enough that it sort of makes up for all the stuff that you can kind of see coming, like the scary hospital and the RV breaking down. And I was surprised that when they got out west, the air was not contaminated. That did surprise me.
Yeah, like you said, when the car's following, like once they get under the underpass, that's it. You never see the car again. And I thought that was
smart.
Yeah, and I thought that was a really great choice to not make it about, because I thought it was going to devolve into this, you know, thing where they're attacked by people too. And that's what I thought. It was like, you know, Jeff was going to be destroyed, or, you know, or Goodyear was going to be harmed. And no. And so parts of it are predictable a little bit, but I think there are other parts that are definitely not. So I kind of like that mixing up, because I think it plays with your expectations and it plays with the tension. And I actually really appreciated that and think it was really well done. I just want to say about the story, when he's telling the story about meeting Goodyear and the mother and daughter and how sad that is. I think there's another layer to it that is so incredibly sad, because Jeff is so desperate, which I think is interesting to say that a robot is so desperate for approval, but Jeff is desperate for Finch's approval. Mm-hmm. Jeff gets really excited about things. He gets really sad when Finch is mad at him, when he doesn't listen, or when he thinks he's doing what Finch wants, but he's not. So, you know, he's like, we're going to make it. I believe in you. And then Finch tells this horrible story. And he's like, you know, hunger turned men into monsters and it made me a coward. How can you get behind that? And Tom Hanks says it in such a kind of deflated, defeated way that it just like broke my heart. So the story broke my heart, and then that broke my heart, and then Jeff wanting his approval so desperately and like having this optimism broke my heart. So it was just like boom, 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 just crying. I was sobbing uncontrollably throughout this film. Like, it was just a hotbed of tears. It was ridiculous.
Yeah. There was a reason I was referring to this week's show as Tom Hanks Tearjerker Week, between this and A League of Their Own. It's definitely both got the waterworks going.
Yeah. Like, Evan, you were talking earlier about how, you know, you usually have a little bit of tears, but not like the ooh-hoo-hoo-hoo sobbing. I was like sobbing. Like, by the end of this film, I was convulsing. Like, just thinking about it again made me like all emotional and sobbing. It was ridiculous.
Yeah. Well, getting back to what you were saying before, they maybe set this expectation with the, you know, the person who is pursuing them that maybe they'll come back. And I thought maybe the film would go into one of those, like, you know, Finch is going to die in a violent blaze of glory protecting Jeff and the dog. Right. And I'm glad they didn't go that route, because I think it was much more impactful to have Finch die of the radiation poisoning and having Jeff stuck there thinking, well, what do I even do?
Poor Jeff.
Like, when he realizes, I know what Finch will do. I'll feed the dog. And then he's playing with the dog. And I love that that's not the end. Yeah. Like, I love seeing that they get back on the road again and that they do find their way to the Golden Gate Bridge. And then we don't know what happens to them after that. But I like that they leave the little postcard there with the drawing of the robot and Finch and the dog on it. I just thought that was really cute.
I love that. And I love that he gives Finch a Viking burial. And I love that he leaves the little like sign saying, you know, Finch Weinberg was loved by Goodyear and Jeff. And I just loved that so much. Like, that just made me cry all over again. I was like, geez.
Yeah.
And I also love that there are so many people who left their photos and postcards like, I'm okay. I went up north, or, you know, I went down south, or I love that we see notes like that. And that also really, really reminded me of The Last of Us 2, because there's so much extraneous information that you can glean from reading other people's notebooks or reading the back of photographs. And I love that this wove that throughout the film. Like, even in the beginning of the film, when Finch is going through his library and he's having Dewey scan books to download into Jeff, and one of the books is The Little Prince, and we see someone who wrote in the book, like, to my little prince, and it kind of showcases the larger world. And I think that's something the film does quite well really early on, is its world building. And I think there are a lot of great little moments like that.
Yeah, it's one of the few movies I can think of in recent memory where I actually paused because I wanted to look at his map that he was using. I was genuinely interested in, like, the geography and the world in then which he was living in a way that I don't typically do. I paused and was like walking up the screen trying to figure out, like, where the radius, blast radius of whatever happened was.
I agree. I was doing that too. I just think it's a great attention to detail.
Yeah.
And something we haven't discussed, I think it's really interesting because while I have not seen Repo Men, which was Mikhail Sapochnik's first film, I'm very familiar with his work because he did so much directing on Game of Thrones, as well as a ton of other TV shows. But he really made his name doing Game of Thrones, like some of the most popular episodes, and especially visually popular with like the Battle of the Bastards and Hard Home. And I was really intrigued to see what he would do on a kind of smaller scale, like smaller with like less of cast, like a smaller cast, but still a lot of ideas sci-fi wise. I think it was really, really well executed. And also I think Caleb Landry Jones is fantastic as Jeff.
He's great.
He's so great.
Mm-hmm. He is. I love Jeff. Yeah. And I like Jeff's evolution, because at first I was getting kind of annoyed with his like vocal patterns. I was like, am I listening to like the robot version of Borat? But I like that his speech evolves too, as his character evolved too. So it felt, his vocal patterns felt more natural. And then I feel like I was like, okay, yeah, now I see Caleb Landry Jones in this character. And that's not just like a silly kind of imitation or whatnot. But yeah, I was really impressed. This is the second Apple TV Plus movie I've seen with Tom Hanks. Greyhound was the other one. And so far, 2 out of 2. I think both are great movies, and I'm excited to see whatever next thing is that he's going to do with them. Because I imagine probably not just 2 movies that he signed on to do for them. So I'm pleased with both.
Well, this was a Universal movie until COVID, right? So it became an Apple Plus
movie. Oh. Yeah. I didn't realize that.
Yeah. Yeah, it was supposed to come out, I want to say, a year ago.
Yeah.
And it was delayed a couple of times, just like every other fucking movie.
pretty much.
Yeah, and then they were probably like, oh, fuck it, just put it out. So, but I do agree with you, Evan, that this is a good 2 for 2 solid Apple TV Plus thing. I mean, I hesitate to get on the Tom Hanks bandwagon just because I like to be a contrarian. But I like Tom Hanks a lot, and he just, you know, he brings it home, you know, and he dies well. He always dies well on screen. even in Philadelphia, where I think his death is actually a little too neat, I still think he plays it very well.
Yeah, but he does a great job in that film.
Yeah. So
he does a great job in every film.
Yeah, I really appreciate the one of you said this, how he's always Tom Hanks, but he's also not.
Yes, Tom Hanks. I said that when we talked about League of Their. Thank you. I'm so glad you said that.
Yeah.
I just to interject, I said when we were talking about A League of Their Own that yes, he always has that quintessential Tom Hanks charisma. He's always that, but he just kind of melts into every single character that he plays, and he really does play such a wide variety of characters. But he always gives such a lived in, really felt performance, and I love that about him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Same.
I just love Tom Hanks so much.
Great.
I know, even if it's not going to be a great movie, I'm going to have such a great time watching him. And this was a great movie.
All right. Do we have any other parting thoughts about Finch?
Bad title.
Yeah.
I don't think it's that bad, but it's not great.
Yeah, it's not great.
I don't know. I go back and forth. One minute I'm like, yeah, it is bad. And then I'm like, no, it's not that bad. But it's not
great. Well, and the original title was BIOS, which is not much better.
No, that's terrible too.
Yeah, not a great title. No.
Great movie, but not necessarily a great title.
It's okay. If the bad title is the worst thing I've got to say about a movie, then I think we're in pretty good shape. Yeah.
Although I don't.
I mean, at least they.
Oh, yes.
Go ahead, Megan. No, go.
I was just going to say, I don't think we needed Tom Hanks's voiceover again at the end, but that's probably my one quibble with the film.
Mm. I was just going to say, I'm glad they didn't call it Chappie 2, which is what it was originally called before.
Oh my God, you're obsessed with Chappie. There are so many robot movies out there and you're fixated on Chappie.
I know. You know why? It's because Chappie produces such strong reactions in people.
I guess. I never saw it, but you're right. It does. But see, to me, not only is it the nod to Silent Running because of Dewey, it also is very similar to Silent Running to me in many ways. The environmentalism about how we're destroying the planet, mm-hmm. the fact that the robots are the ones taking care of the plants in Silent Running, and this is a robot taking care of a dog. Maybe I should watch Chappie now. Anyway.
Yeah. And you should watch Silent Running, listeners, if you've never seen it. And then you should become a patron. And then you can go into our back catalog and listen to our episode about Silent Running.
Yes, because it's so good.
Hear us talk about how Bruce Dern, even though he's not so Bruce Dern, is still Bruce Dern.
Always and forever. Yeah, I just, one more thing I want to say about Finch is it's very clear it's pulling from a lot of other sci-fi sources. We didn't even mention this. It also has Isaac Asimov's three laws of robotics. And so it's pulling from that. It's pulling from Silent Running. Mm-hmm. It's pulling from possibly The Last of Us. There's another video game that it reminded me of, Far Alone Sales, that it's possibly pulling from. It's pulling from a lot of different source material, but I think that it does enough to stand its own ground and make it its own story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I didn't sit there watching, feeling like it was ripping everything off.
Right. I felt more like it's like, oh, this inspired that, or oh, this is an homage to that. Yes. 100%.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So let's do a recap here. So it sounds like we would all say that you should see Beans.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. That, I believe, will be available on demand. It sounds like we would all recommend Passing as well.
Yep.
Oh my God, yes. I think this is one of the best films of the year.
And that's currently in theaters, but will very soon be on Netflix for you to see. And lastly, Finch, which is actually going to be available on Apple TV Plus. And it sounds like we'd recommend that. This is a weird week.
Yeah.
Wow.
All three of us on board with all three films.
Who
I know.
Would have thunk it? Holy moly.
I know.
Yeah. Hell has frozen over. But I love it.
It's not a bad thing.
No, I love it. I mean, love that we're all so enthusiastic this week about all three films. It's awesome.
Me too. Also feels good to watch three good movies and not be like upset. Spent time watching a movie that I just abhor.
I feel like that's been happening to us way too often lately.
For sure. But let's see. So we want to say a huge thank you to our editor, Otto Klammer. Otto, thank you for making us sound good week in and week out. We appreciate you.
Thanks, Otto.
You can find the show anywhere you get podcasts, but you can also find us at our website, which is spoilerpiece.com. We are all over social media. We're Spoiler Piece Theater on Facebook. We're at Spoiler Piece on Twitter, Instagram, Letterboxd, and TikTok. If you want to get in touch with us about any of these movies or past or present episodes, whatever you want to do, you just want to say hi, you can send us an email, spoilerpiece@gmail.com, or you can give us a call
at 862-21-PIECE.
Yes, you can leave us a message, you can text us even. There's multiple ways to get in touch with us. We'd love to hear from you. And if you like the show, please rate and review us. You can go to ratethispodcast.com/spoilerpiece. Rate us, review us. We very much appreciate it. It helps more people find the show. And if you really, really like the show, check out our Patreon, patreon.com/spoilerpiece. You can sign up to get exclusive audio like this week's. We talk about A League of Their Own, There's also somewhere in the neighborhood of 200 pieces of bonus audio that you get, mini episodes, basically, that you can sign up and listen to. You can vote in polls, all kinds of good stuff. So definitely check that out. And so thank you for joining us this week. My name is Evan Crean. I'm co-chair of the Boston Online Film Critics Association and co-author of Your 80s Movie Guide to Better Living. You can follow me on Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd as Real Recon, and that's real as in film reel.
My name is Megan Kearns. I write film reviews for Edge Media Network. I, too, am a member of the Boston Online Film Critics Association. You can follow me on Twitter at OpinionSWorld and on Instagram or Letterboxd at TheOpinionS.
My name is Dave Riedel. I write about movies. I'm a member of the Boston Online Film Critics Association. And if you'd like to follow me online, I am on Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd as Dave Sees Movies.
We'll see you next week.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.